My name is Auke van Sloten. I'm a web developer. I've been doing this stuff since about 1996. And the last few years I've been building a software system that is a middleware between all kinds of different APIs. And it's a mess. So the idea is that I'm trying to get to a point where the connecting to an API and getting some information from it is not as much a chore as it is right now. So, as a colleague of mine mentioned, that if I wanted to make people enthusiastic about something, I should not focus on the features. I should tell you how the system will change your life for the better. If you buy my product, your life will be better. And also important, this presentation is meant to be interactive. So if you have a question, put up your hand and ask away. So, imagine a world where you don't have to hand code a client for a specific API. You don't even have to parse an open API spec and run some magic code to generate some kind of client library for you. There's just a single client code that is working for every API out there. It's of course JavaScript, the one true language out there. No booze, okay. There is no separate query language to learn. There's no SQL, there's no GraphQL, there's no object relational mapping, no injection attacks, of course. Everything is just JavaScript. The APIs endpoints are not something that you will have to search for in some kind of documentation. The endpoints follow normally from the data that is in there. There are no filter or paging arguments to send in a weird syntax. And all the data runs on a server in memory where your query will also run, so everything is fast by default. And most importantly, the API is future-proof, so your client code doesn't need to be updated whenever the API changes. You can just use the old version, or you can automate updating it to whatever new thing is invented later. There are no flying cars, but we do have time travel. Does this sound any way better than the current crop of APIs? Good. Then the rhetorical question is, I said all APIs suck. I'm really interested in what you think. Do APIs currently suck? And I mean online APIs. No, nobody thinks they suck?
Some of them do. Some of them do, but they okay. Do a lot of great work.
All right. So you like programming to, say,
no,
a REST API?
I don't program them.
Ah, right. Okay. Then the thing is, if I want to make a good API, we have to somehow define what a good API is. So I gave you a glimpse earlier on, but most people these days say, well, a REST API, that's how stuff is supposed to work. So who knows what a REST API is? Can you tell me? Is there a way for a microphone to, or do I have to repeat the question? That's also possible.
It is a network-based API that uses HTTP to request a resource, typically through a URL, and then a response will be delivered from the server, typically in the form of text, JSON, or some other data format. Sometimes even empty content.
All right. So that's the common answer. And that is what today we mean with a REST API. But the original meaning of REST is a bit wider than that. The most important thing, REST stands for Representational State Transfer. And it was not invented, it was reverse engineered from the biggest software system that we as humanity have ever made, the World Wide Web. And a researcher was thinking, well, why is this thing, the World Wide Web, so successful, so large, where any other system that we've designed fails to scale even to a small fraction of the web? And he wrote some rules and named that rule set REST. So the World Wide Web is the one true REST API out there. All other REST APIs that I have found are missing a few fairly minor features, like types in your data. It's kind of important for a document-centric thing like the web. Each document has a type, it's called a MIME type, and it allows the browser to infer what to do with that data. If we have an API, we have fine-grained data, and you would like to have some type information in that data to automatically be able to infer what to do with that. That's not actually there, usually. Another thing that you would like to have is information on what can I do with this data, in the form of links, for example, or form actions or stuff like that. That's also usually not there. So instead of REST, what we really have is JSON over HTTP. And that's the state of the art. JSON has a slight problem here, because JSON is never just JSON. To understand a JSON data format, you need to know what service you're talking to. You need to read the documentation, see how they encoded certain things that are difficult to encode in JSON. So there's a lot of thinking, reading, custom programming to really make use of that stuff. GraphQL is a recent improvement on REST, in that they said it is important that you keep the round trips between your client and the server to as limited amount as possible, because each round trip adds lag, adds more time between responses. So GraphQL allows you to, in your query, state up front, I'd like to have this and this and this and this information. Please give it to me in one go so I don't have to go and fetch more. So that's an improvement. But GraphQL is, again, limited. The implementation of GraphQL differ widely, and you'll need to read up again on how is this GraphQL server implementing GraphQL exactly, and which enhancements does it have, and how can I use that. Then there is OpenAPI. How many people here have heard about OpenAPI? It used to be called Swagger. It's one, two, all right, three, yeah, few. OpenAPI is an attempt to write down how your API is actually designed in such a way that I can automatically generate a client for it, so that I don't have to do the hand coding of a client. And that's a nice idea. Years ago, there used to be something called SOAP, and SOAP had a similar idea, and they used XML language called WSDL, for web service description language, to try and do almost exactly the same thing. And of course, everybody uses SOAP these days because it was a runaway success. Slight sarcasm there. So I think OpenAPI is just traveling right in the same direction and is going for the same, heading for the same problems. You have a generated client, and then the specification changed, so you need to regenerate your client. But the client has changed because the specification has changed. So now you need to refactor your code to use the new client. And we're back to square one. And we haven't actually even talked about the meaning of the data. This is just, how do I call your API to get some data? There is no description of meaning in there at any point. So a typical REST stack these days is, this is just a simple one. There are many much more complex ones out there. But you have typically a few things. There's the client side. I'm using a browser-based app for an example here. Then there's the server, and then there's your database. Usually that's a relational database, so that is SQL. Your server is some kind of framework that connects to your database. That needs to translate the relational data into more object-oriented data. Many people use object relational mapping for that, and that is one of the most complex pieces of software you can introduce in your own system. Please don't, but people still do. Then you need to define the endpoints, which URLs are you going to listen to, and what kind of information am I going to push on those endpoints. Then you need to translate your data from your internal object structure to JSON, which is not trivial. You need to be aware of all kinds of problems in there. And then you need to have an API on the client side that calls your service, maybe generated through an open API specification. That translates JSON again to your internal data structures, and then you can use it in your application in the browser. There's a lot of moving parts in this system, and more importantly, there's a lot of translation from one data format to another data format to another data format. So a lot of stuff can go wrong here, and it usually does. Right. I already mentioned some of those issues. There are many more, but first one, all the different formats. There is an, what's called an impedance mismatch, that you cannot accurately translate everything in, from one language into another. So you'll have to define your own custom formatting for that. There is no idea what kind of data you're actually accessing when you requesting a URL. You don't know which URLs are there unless you read the Open API spec. And if I ask for information from a URL, what kind of information am I going to get back? This is all undefined behavior, and everybody implements their own system for that. People have tried to make this easier by writing standardized frameworks, and then you just use this framework, connect to a relational database, and it will automatically create endpoints for you with what's called CRUD, create, read, update, delete semantics. But what you're actually doing is almost exporting your relational database to the web. And you have almost direct access to tables and columns and rows and stuff like that, which is not the way we usually think about application data. And it's also inherently not transactional. So if I have to update each element of a table, each row separately from a remote system, and the network breaks halfway through, the data is suddenly in an inconsistent state. So these CRUD semantics are really the kind of the worst kind of way to actually use an API. Then we are on the web, but we haven't had any real links. JSON has no link type. I can use a string with a URL in it, but I have to know that it is a URL. And I have to really make sure that when I parse something, that I know the semantics of what that URL is trying to tell me. And one I found out fairly late is that there's a lot of confusion about the identity of data. In a database, you have rows. Each row has an ID. And that ID you can use to link stuff to. In a REST API, usually each object also has an ID. Whatever that ID may be, we don't know. It's up to the person implementing the API. Lately, UUIDs, the universally unique IDs, have become popular. and they solve quite a few of these issues, but they don't really tell you much besides it is an ID. So what happens is that services use URLs as an ID and then add the UUID inside there somewhere. And you have, for example, a database with cars, and then the REST API is example.com/cars/some ID. And then you know, all right, so this ID is probably a car. But it doesn't have to be, because things change in the world. In fact, it mixes type information with provenance, where does this come from, with identity. And once you mix stuff, things become problematic later on when the world changes. As an example of things that can go wrong, I thought I'd show a few minor things and bigger systems. Azure from Microsoft is a famous system. Everybody here is aware of that it exists. But one of the things that is less clear if you start out first is it's not one API. It is a mix of many different systems. And there's probably a single group of people in Microsoft that try to hide all that stuff behind a single API endpoint. But differences in implementations do leak through. And one of those differences is, how do I write a identity URL for anything inside Azure? And there is about six different ways to do this. All of them sort of almost like each other, but not quite. Some services return identities in one form, other services in another. Some require a specific form if you enter any data. So now you have to read data, transform the identity to a different format, and send that to the same API, otherwise things won't work. And these are just a few of the things that I have found inside Azure. Notice the extra quotes here. Those are not optional. But they are optional in the groups syntax. So, you know, simple things. Then there's Google. Google has a very large API service. And it's very well documented, as long as you look at the basic URL syntax. So which endpoints, which require which parameters, and what kind of data will it return. It's very well documented. But then I like to use my native client, and they make a library for that, and say I use PHP, I can install the default Google RPC client in PHP, and I get about 27,000 lines of PHP. And there's a single README describing that API, a single document of a few hundred lines. And if you need to know more, they happily point you to a generated class documentation of the thing. So that's not very helpful, especially since they changed the semantics of the REST API to be more PHP-like. So now I don't actually know what I need to send, because what's documented in the REST API is not the format that the client library is using. And the client library, of course, is not documented. And this is Google. So if Microsoft and Google can't create a perfect API based on REST, maybe it's best if we just throw REST out and try to redesign something that is more well-defined and less open for interpretation, and for different interpretations as well. So, it's maybe not very readable. What it says here is, let's innovate. What do we really need in 2023? Because the world has changed a bit since we designed most of the stuff that we're using these days. databases are designed in the 60s, I think, relational databases, maybe the 70s. And in that time, the CPUs were not as powerful as today. Memory was very expensive. So you couldn't use, you had to use a lot of indexes and read as few things as possible from the hard disk. These days, memory is still slower than their CPU. And SSDs are still slower than memory. So relatively, that still holds up. But the data set that I can now store in main memory is so much bigger than we could even dream of like 30 years ago. Do the same thing still hold for designing a system today compared to 30 years ago? And I've posited that it really doesn't for most use cases. Case in point, I researched how much does it cost to have a server online with, say, 2 terabytes of main memory. So not 2 terabytes of disk, but 2 terabytes of main memory. And I found some systems available for about 1,400 euros per month. And that is a lot of money for you and I personally, but for a company, that's like nothing. And most data sets fit very comfortably within that amount of memory. So I don't really have to think about storing stuff on disk most of the time. If you have data sets that are larger than that, then yeah, you're gonna need to use the existing difficult to use stuff, because I've been thinking about writing something. I wanna keep it as simple as possible. And I've said, well, I'm only gonna focus on stuff that will fit in memory. That's one of the things that I've done. This is the context that I'm trying to keep to make a research thing, something that we can tinker with and see, well, does this actually work? Is this an improvement over the old thing without having to write like thousands and thousands and thousands of lines of code? So I've limited scope to keep things simple. I used to call this the 80% use case. I want to create a solution for about 80% of the problem space and focus on that. And the other 20% of the problem space usually takes up another 80% of your code. So this keeps things small. The other thing is I've focused on APIs that are read optimized, so the reads highly outweigh the writes. And again, all data should be available in memory. I have no problem whatsoever with HTTP. I really like it, so I'm not gonna innovate on that. JSON, though, is not as great as I would like. Is anybody here aware of things like linked data or the semantic web? All right, for those who don't know this, Sir Tim Berners-Lee has been trying to get us into the next generation of the web by adding meaning to the data. And the way they did this, I think it started around 2010, I'm not quite sure, is in that time, you use XML, of course. And the idea was that each thing you want to say about something is encoded in such a way that you know the exact meaning of what you're encoding, not just the data. And being Sir Tim Berners-Lee, he did that by using URLs for everything. But another thing which is more surprising is he used something called predicate logic. Most famously known from, I think, Prolog. And this is a knowledge-based thing designed in the 70s. So it was used for artificial intelligence before we used neural networks for that stuff. And it means that you store data as a set of triples, where you have some subject, some kind of relation, and an object. So everything you can say about anything you divide in these triples, where the middle part is the predicate, the relation, and the left and the right are entities that you relate to each other in a certain way. I've been using LinkData for a few years now on the Solid project, which is also a new thing from Tim Berners-Lee, where they add an API to the whole LinkData format, LinkData platform, it's called. And it is actually almost what I described earlier in can we build something like this? Imagine a world where everybody was using Solid and LinkData, and most of those lines that I wrote on that highlight there would be finished. It would be done. One problem though, it's really difficult to use LinkData in an application. You need to really rethink how you use data. You basically need to use Prolog to reason about the data, which obviously doesn't work. So I want to go to LinkData because it solves a lot of these problems, but it makes application programming massively much more complicated. So I think we need to have something between JSON and LinkData, something that is easy to program with, but it does have meaning, and I can change it to something larger. I don't like the document-centric REST APIs because they hide whatever is inside them. And one other thing that REST is not very good at is asynchronous updates. And asynchronicity is very important for large-scale APIs, so I want to embrace that. How do we go about writing something that potentially is a completely new system? We have to be aware of the different requirements for different elements of any system. And the bottom element is infrastructure. There's supposed to be an extra line under there, but infrastructure needs to be very simple. It needs to be fixed, and it needs to be durable. That's the missing line below there. You don't want infrastructure changing too often. You don't want to have custom code to read specific parts of the infrastructure. And JSON is doing very well for all those things. It's simple, it's fixed, it's durable. And I think that's one of the reasons that JSON is so well-known and well-used. The problem is that on the platform side, we need a bit more than that. And JSON is not powerful enough to support something that is slightly more flexible. And that's the reason why we have a lot of stuff out there like OpenAPI, because JSON itself cannot really represent all the information that you have. But if you go above the platform to the application level, that's where we really want something that is flexible, that is powerful, that can handle complex situations. But it means that it is less durable and it is less all-encompassing. So can we build something that works on the infrastructure and on the platform level, and then the application level I leave for another time? I've been trying to do stuff like that. On the infrastructure level, HTML is the example to strive for. This is something that has blown away everything else that was out there. If you do anything document-centric, or even application building, you're using HTML. JSON, it has the same level of being everywhere, but it is much less powerful. And the first HTML had about 25 elements, but it also had attributes where you could add custom information to this fixed set of HTML elements. JSON has 5 types, null not included, and there is no way to extend it. There's no way to add extra attributes or stuff like that. So metadata needs to be encoded in the JSON itself, and there you have collisions between the normal data and the metadata, and then people are going to do fancy things like adding an ampersand or an at sign in front of a property, and now it's a special property, and stuff like that is making our life miserable. So I've gone and updated JSON and added a bit of HTML into it. So I've added tags. It is still backwards compatible. You can still read, parse normal JSON. It will work fine. But I've added about 25 data types to the JSON system. And important, a link type. So I can actually represent link data inside JSON tag. And each tag can have any kind of attribute that you want. Probably be best showing you what I mean. Let's see. Come on. Where's my cursor? Is this readable?
Yeah.
All right. So this is a JSON tag format. And you can see it's just JSON with some weird-ass tags strewn in between them. What this allows is I can now accurately represent not just that it is an object, but I can say, well, this is actually a person. And I can store the data and read it in back, and I don't have to have a separate knowledge about which classes are associated with which arrays or properties. It's basically right in there. I've also added a date type, so now that I know that this is a date, I can automatically create the correct user interface for changing this stuff. There is a lot more besides that. Let me see. Yeah. So here's a list of types that I've defined right now. So what I've done is I've taken a look at what types JavaScript natively supports, which are useful to have, what types databases usually support, and I've taken a look at Postgres for that. Of course, the basic JSON types need to be in there because it needs to be fully backwards compatible. And I've taken a look at something called Rebol or Red language, which famously has a lot of semantic types in the programming language itself. I'm not sure this is the final set of data types. I really like feedback from people if this is something that they want to use or if they miss things. But I also like to keep it as small as possible. So that's the infrastructure part. Let's, can I get this back? Yeah. All right. Where did it get my cursor back? Then the platform. The platform I've called Simply Store because we've been doing a lot of components that are meant to be very simple, and they're all prefixed with simply. The whole presentation is called Simply Present, and is actually running on a solid data pod, so it's already a bit in the future there. And the things that I've decided to do differently than the normal REST systems is embracing asynchronicity. So I've gone for the CQRS design pattern, and that's called Command Query Responsibility Segregation. And there are a few reasons for that. The query part is a separate endpoint, and it will only do queries. So you cannot change data on the query endpoint, which means automatically there is no way to do any kind of injection attack in queries. The query actually runs on an immutable data set, so even if you could break the query engine to do updates, the data set itself just won't allow it. This solves a lot of security concerns that many REST APIs have. Another thing is that the commands are always asynchronous. So there's a separate endpoint where I can send a command. A command can do anything. It can change the data. But it will not reply right away with, I've changed this. The command is actually your transaction. It can do any kind of thing. And most specifically, it doesn't do CRUD. I have not implemented a create, read, update, delete semantics for changing the data, because if you do that, you no longer have any idea what the meaning of the change is. If I say, I want to add a car, then I know, okay, so I have a car, and a car must have a manufacturer, and it may have a year for entry, and it can be data that is stored in a lot of different places, but the command says, I have a new car. So now I know that all these little pieces of data are related to introducing a new car in the system. That's the benefit of CQRS. Then the endpoints are not actually random. You have a data space. That's all the data that that server has to offer you. And each root entry of the data space is also a root entry, an endpoint for your system automatically. And I use that. I do that by using a JSON pointer to point inside the data space, and you get custom results. Then queries, there's no GraphQL, there's no custom language, it's just JavaScript. This is one of the more out there solutions. You're sending JavaScript to the server. The server will run that JavaScript for you and send you the result back. The advantage is, if I have a terabyte of data and my query is 20 lines of JavaScript, it's a lot faster to send the 20 lines of JavaScript to the server than to send a terabyte of data to the client. It also solves one of the main problems. I want to have paging. Well, it is JavaScript. You just add a slice to your query, and you have paging. The next thing is, the SimpliStore is designed as a baseline. And you need to customize it, because each data set has its own requirements. So for example, the commands, it doesn't come with any commands. You will have to write your own. So it's not a separate server. It's a library that you can use to build your own stuff on top of it. Then the command endpoint is using a command log, where each new command creates a new data set that is tied to that entity. And it automatically creates a log, which you can use as an audit log, or you can use it to go back into time and replay all the commands to generate a new set. If somehow you made a bug in your command earlier, now you can go back, fix the bug, rerun all the commands, and you have a up-to-date, correct data set. And finally, well, there's a bit more below this, but the screen doesn't show it. I use UUIDs for everything. And the IDs are not stored in the data. They are stored in the metadata. So it's an attribute in the JSON tag. And the client is in charge of generating IDs. And this is needed because if I send a command to the server to add something, and there's a communication problem, so I don't get an acknowledge back, I can send it again and be sure that even though I sent the same command twice, I won't end up with two entities in the data set, because the ID is the same, so the server will know, all right, I've seen this thing already. So that's for the at least once semantics of the communication system. Finally, everything is in memory, but we're missing one key feature that databases have brought us, and that's ACID compliance. So that means atomicity, consistency, isolation, and durability. We need to make sure that our system also fulfills all those promises as well. So, the thing is already available to tinker with. The state is that it's currently just a read-only data set. I haven't implemented any commands yet. But you can already use it. And I'll try to show a demo here. I have to move that. Is this readable enough?
Yeah.
All right. So this is a query interface I made for a data set. To the right is the list of data that is in this system. It automatically lists that, and I can change the URL and say, what's it called? I think it was called people. And then it will show a list of the people that are in here. So I can use the URL just to browse through the data set and get a kind of a summary of all the data back. Let's go back to the root. On the left, I can create a query in JavaScript syntax. And it will run on the server and send the result back. What it can also do is use a slightly more GraphQL-like syntax. And say, I want a name of everybody in there. There you go. These are all the people in the database. And even though this doesn't really look like JavaScript, it is. It is an extra library I made to create a more user-friendly query language in JavaScript. And it's just array manipulation. It does an array filter and array map. I can do a filter as well. Let's see. So that is a regular expression. It says any name that starts with a capital L. And then I've got a subselection of my data. I can also add a slice here to show me just a limited number of results. So basically, you can do any kind of normal JavaScript programming. What you can't do here is network access, nor disk access, or any special API. It is running in Node, but it is sandboxed, so it's in a special virtual machine. It has no access to anything except your data and a few other bits and pieces that are useful. Yeah, the next things that I want to implement is the commands and the multithreading, and see how far I can get this system to grow. I'm really curious what you people think of this approach, and if there is any flaw in the design of this thing that you can see coming, and if you would be interested in taking it for a spin and see what you like or don't like.
I'll be coming with the microphone.
What about data limits, like rate limits for the client?
Well, that's a good question. The whole idea is right now that I just put it open so anybody can just blast away at it, but you can fairly easily do a denial of service attack, and that's not nice. So what I want to do is add a proxy in front of it, an API gateway, and let it handle things like rate limiting, do something like an API key. So you need to have an API key to actually talk to the system. And then you can do a rate limiting by API key. There are many systems that already implement this kind of stuff, so I thought I'll ignore it and just do something like, what's it called? Traffic? Traffic is an API gateway, that's nice. Or any other system in front of it.
Okay, very interesting concept. I do wonder, how would you actually do joins, like in classical SQL join with the system?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing, because joins are needed when you have normalized your data into separate columns. So what I actually end up doing is, I've this data set, for example, was in separate files, separate JSON files for each type of the people and starships and movies and stuff like that. And then they link to each other by using a number and maybe even a type. And what I've done is I've joined that in memory. So if you ask Luke Skywalker and you go to which starship does it have, it's just right there. You don't need a join because it is already joined. This does presuppose that you know how you're going to relate data to each other. So that is an important thing, similar to many of the NoSQL databases that do the exact same thing.
Any more questions? No? Let's give a big hand.
Thank you.